Hey everybody, what's up? My name is Seth with SethPerlow.com and the Executive Function Online Summit. And I'm really excited here to be with Karen today, who's going to talk a lot about studying. This is Karen Tuiboys from New Zealand. We have somebody coming to us from New Zealand today. And Karen does a lot of speaking around all around multiple countries. She's known as the Study Queen, and she's a champion of lifelong learning, but she does a lot of very practical how-to study techniques for students. So I think this will be a really awesome program for you parents out there to hear some really practical strategies that you can use for your child that struggles with executive function. So Karen, what I'm going to do is ask you for a brief description of what we're going to learn, and then we'll do an in-depth discussion about who you are and your background, and then we'll get into the meat of the talk. So in a nutshell, what are people going to learn today?
So I'm going to share with you some study tips on how you can help your students to be able to learn. I'll share with you some tips as parents about how you can help them support your teens through exams and through their learning journey. And I'll also give you 16 different ways that that you can help your students to become habitually better at that thinking and their learning.
Awesome. And as far as your background, not professionally, who are you? What are you interested in? What occupies your time? Who are you just as a regular everyday person there?
Well, obviously I live in New Zealand. And so if you're not sure where that is, it is at the bottom of the world, but we are not, I have to say this, we are not in Australia. So we are the paradise of the world. And so what I love is actually rainbows and sunshine. And so we get a lot of that. We get a lot of rain, we get a lot of sunshine. So I get a lot of rainbows. I love being outdoors. I have two children who are 17 and 19. So I've almost been, you know, finished the school time. And I have one husband. And I love spending time with my family. So we love being at the beach, and I'm also crafty. I love making things and doing things. So that's me off work.
Awesome, awesome. Are you close to the beach?
In New Zealand, anywhere you live, anyone is only 2 hours from the beach. However, I'm about 10 minutes drive.
I've heard that you can be skiing in the morning and in the water in the afternoon, surfing. Is that true?
Yes, that's absolutely true.
And tell us why do hearts speak to you so much?
You see the hearts in the background. I was a teacher for many years, and what I see in teaching and in learning right now is that the heart has often gone out of the teaching and learning. So my company is about putting the heart back into teaching and learning, that social emotional learning, the fun and the excitement back into the learning. So the hearts are our symbol.
Awesome. I love it. And for those of you parents that are watching that haven't heard the term SE or social emotional, it really is a way of looking at education that goes beyond just the academic and into our social life and our emotional life, because we are social creatures, we are emotional creatures. Tell us about your professional background. How did you get here?
So I was put on this planet to teach. I've always known I was destined to be a teacher. And so when I left university as a teacher, I taught in a classroom, in primary classroom, with six-year-olds. And I got to the point in my teaching where I realized that children were coming into school with that light in their eyes, with that excitement, with the love of learning. But I watched about age 7 and 8 as that light died. And I went, what are we doing in education that is not serving our children, that is not allowing them to be the best that they can be and to love learning? And I also realized as a teacher and at college or university, I had been taught what to teach, not how to teach.
So and my kids are taught what to learn and not how to learn.
That was my next step. It's like, well, these children being, that's okay. Do you predict lotto numbers as well?
No, we're just kindred spirits on the same page here.
So I really wanted to know, how do we teach students how to learn, not what to learn? So I've been on a 25-year mission to learn, to find out, and then to share.
Awesome. So you had said something earlier that, oh yeah, I've heard a lot of parents right around third grade, and this is probably one of the top three scariest things that I've heard from parents, but they say, when it first grips parents, it's really terrifying. And they say, I'm afraid that my child is going to lose their love of learning. And they're saying this because they're starting to see it happen. And then obviously we get into middle school and high school, where a lot of times we hear students who say, I hate school. Correct. I hate this class. I hate math. I hate reading. And what a disservice, and what a sad state. Like, learning, I don't think that they actually hate learning. I think that they hate how it feels in their relationship with school sometimes, or with the subject matter or the teacher, or how they feel about themselves with it. But it's not about the learning. Everybody loves learning. So how do, I'm excited to break this down for you, with you.
Yes. So I totally agree. So definitely at that grade three, at that middle school, where they're just sort of hanging out and not sure what's, you know, they're waiting for the next step. So it's about, for me, I work a lot with teachers, teaching them how to engage, how to enroll, how to make information exciting, but also how to make it meaningful and purposeful, so that we're not just teaching students so they can pass a test, but that we're actually providing that holistic curriculum and giving student voice, student choice, and allowing students to feel like they're part of the process rather than the process being done to them.
Mm. I don't even know where to start, but I'm on the same page as you. You said the word engagement. I one of the things that I'll say sometimes, I think engagement is the most important word in teaching. And if we were, you know, we have all these ways in America, we have these ways of evaluating teachers. But I think that the best way to evaluate a teacher is, how engaged is your class? And ask the kids, and then go from there. But we don't design curriculum around engagement. Or you said the word choice. We don't ask kids what do you think? I use the word ownership and buy, the words ownership and buy-in a lot. We don't do a lot of that. So you get to take teachers and help inspire them to figure out how to make it more engaging. Oh, and you said meaningful and purposeful. That's another thing I talk about all the time. What's the point of all of this if it's not meaningful and purposeful? And it's not rocket science to do this, but our paradigms, our educational paradigms, as I'm sure you know a lot more than I, because of you're talking so much to teachers, but they're not designed like that.
Correct. And I think it's about making sure that our teachers are empowered to have choice in their classrooms as well, because if they're just teaching to a test, and I get the big picture is that, you know, how do you test for relationships, for choice, for thinking, but you can test knowledge. And so our education system has been based in that exam system, and it's very slowly changing. Which is exciting.
Yeah, and I often talk about that some of the most important things are not quantifiable. They're not things that we can test. So, but we have this story about how important tests are and assessment. It's important to look at knowledge and learning and all that, but you can't take a test to see a kid say, oh, I feel so good about myself, like that. You don't test that. Or I don't feel good about myself. Like, but those are super important things that you can't really quantify, or if you can, it's not really that useful. But to have that discussion is very important.
Absolutely. And that leads on to the 16 behaviors that we actually explicitly teach. And so these are, I guess, executive function strategies, ideas, things like, and we can measure.
I'll get into those in a minute.
Okay.
I'm going to do a couple more sort of background questions. What do you feel like is your superpower as far as working with people with executive function struggles?
Practical strategies, the how-tos, particularly when I'm working with teenagers, students, making sure they understand that passing exams has got nothing to do with intelligence. It's not got to do with how smart you are. It's actually to do with the strategies and the techniques you use when you are studying. So I think that's part of my superpower, is provide those strategies and techniques which give students hope, which gives them positivity, which gives them the belief that they can do it. And then, of course, they can.
And then how would you define executive function in one sentence? And then you can explain it. But if you were to have to, I didn't tell Karen that this question was coming. Or anybody.
Executive function in one. Well, I believe it's the thinking processes, the behavior, being able to manage yourself, being able to think about your thinking. So it's that whole, all this great stuff that happens in the frontal lobe here.
Awesome. And then break it down for us a little bit more.
So yes. So around study and exams, it's about being able to manage yourself, being able to plan, have time management skills. It's being able to think about your thinking and reflect on what you've done. Was it a good strategy? Was there a better strategy? Is there another way you can do this? It's about goal setting. It's about all of those different strategies that allow us to be able to be successful in what we're doing.
All right. Awesome. Now we'll dive into sort of the meat of the problem and then the solution. So we'll spend quite a bit of time going over. I'm going to ask you some different questions about the problems that you see, how they show up in your work. So first of all, how would you describe the A to B in what you see? You're more working with teachers now, or do you still work with kids?
I work with students every week.
So you got, okay, so let's look at students in particular. So these parents are watching, and you are working with a student who's at point A, you're trying to get them to point B. Somebody comes to you and says, I'm really concerned about the student because they're at point A, and then you help them make a transformation and they're at point B. What does that look like in your world?
Well, point A can be several different points where our students are starting. Some of them are starting at total avoidance. They're doing everything they can to avoid learning, to avoid studying, to avoid school. So parents, you'll know this in the home. These are the students who, when you said, have you got any homework, they say, can I empty the dishwasher? Have you got any jobs, mum or dad? And you're like, what? They're distracted on social media. They are doing everything they can to not do any learning. So they start often at that avoidance stage. The next stage I see is a stage that I call anxious. So here's where I see students who are just anxious that they're not going to pass, that they're worried about failure. They're worried about the reflection of their results on their parents' love for them, which, you know, as parents, we love our children unconditionally, but actually our children don't necessarily know that. And so they often worry, you know, what if I let my parents down? What if they don't love me because I haven't passed that test or an exam? What if I don't meet their expectations? So often that anxiousness is something that I'm spending time dealing with for students. Then we get students who move into the next phase, which is that ability to be able to stop and think and go, hey, I'm doing okay, but I want to do better. How do I get better? Increase my marks? How do I be more productive? How can I halve my study time? And then we have, point B is where we want to get them to. Maybe it's CDE, I don't know. But at that point, we really want students at the where they've got a plan, where they are just ticking off the plan, that they're learning, they're feeling empowered as learners. So that's sort of our end result.
I like that you use the word feeling, the words of feeling empowered. What does it look like when they feel empowered as learners?
Well, in the classroom, they ask questions. They are looking for information if they don't know it. They are they've got a plan and they've got a study time and a study place. And they know, by the way, that learning is hard. Learning isn't always fun and exciting. Learning, particularly new things, is difficult and challenging. And so they know that, but they're empowered to have the strategies to be able to move through that hard to get to what I call the easy.
Awesome. I like that. And I like, you're right. It is hard. It takes time and it's okay.
Yes.
Yeah. We don't have to rush through everything. And
correct.
And we can really engage or immerse in the learning in this massive process. Awesome.
Yes, learning is often just messy. And so it often feels difficult and hard. But that's really good when you realize that. We sort of talk about it goes okay, and then you go into this dip of difficult and hard, and you want to quit and you want to give up, and then you persevere and you use some of the strategies and you get some help and you ask the questions and you Google what you're stuck on, and then you start coming back up the other side of that dip and until you can go, eureka, I actually understand.
Mm-hmm. And let's see, what are, when people do start working with you, whether it's the parents of the kids or the kids themselves, what are some of the blind spots that you see maybe for parents and kids? I assume it depends on the stage that they're at, because if they're in more of the avoidance stage, then the blind spot would seems in my experience to be, they don't see any problem at all. Just let me play video games. But seriously, what are some of the blind spots that are common that you see?
That's a good question. I think probably some of the blind spots I think parents find is that they think their child's doing okay, but they're not actually. So they're doing all the right things, they're saying all the right things, but it's not until you get to the end of the year, end of the semester, that you realize actually they're not doing as well as they could have. That students are sort of faking it till they make it, and sometimes it's not enough. One of the biggest blind spots for students, though, is that when they pass something, that they feel that euphoria and they feel like, yay, I've passed and I'm doing okay. But actually, there's still a whole lot of information they don't know. And because it's scaffolded, because one year after the other is scaffolded on top of the other, if you've got, as Sal Khan from Khan Lab School talks about, there's holes in what he calls the Swiss cheese. And if there's holes in the foundation, then it's hard to add the next step. So probably the biggest blind spot I see, which, and my solution to that is my most important study tip I can ever teach, and that is to learn what you don't know. You see, what most students do is they go home and they study what they do know. Now, I'm going to ask you, Seth, and I'm going to ask the parents who are watching, are you a to-do list person? Do you write to-do lists? Do you, Seth?
Oh, yes. Yeah, multiple. Yeah.
Let me ask you this question. Have you ever gone to cross something off your to-do list and it's not there?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe the parents will experience this.
What do you mean?
So you've done a job and you go, great, I can cross that off my list. And you go to your list and the job's not there. You hadn't written it on your list. So what people do
I write everything down. So it's on there somewhere, but I might have 5 million lists.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying.
So sometimes what people do is they write it on the list just so they can cross it off.
I have done that.
Yes. Now, there's no logical reason for this, but there is a physiological reason. Because when you cross something off your list, it makes you feel good.
If I have a sense of accomplishment or something.
Those endorphins through your brain that tells you you've done a great job. and it makes us feel good. This is why students go home and study what they already know. It makes them feel good. Oh, I know that. I'm so clever. I'm amazing. I've got this. But that's not learning. Learning is learning what you don't know. And the challenge we have with our learners, and this is the big blind spot, I believe, is that when they start learning what they don't know, it's hard. It's difficult. It's frustrating. And they've been sold this lie that says learning should be fun. But it's not always fun. It's hard sometimes. So I talk to students about to get to easy, you have to go through hard. And so my strategies are all about how do you do the hard? How do you learn the information that you don't know? So that's a huge blind spot for many of our students. They're just doing it because it feels good. They want to feel good. They are used to social media giving them endorphin hits, dopamine hits all the time. Yes, I got 10 likes today. Yes, these people like my posts, my social media feed, and they love that hit of dopamine. And learning what you don't know doesn't give you that hit of dopamine until you get through to the other side.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of a student that you worked with recently that went from that don't know to that know point? Yes.
So I was working with a student who was doing a studying for a test where she was being asked about the history of the Olympic Games and technology and how once upon a time there was the Olympic Games would happen, but it was took 3 days for them to videotape it, put it in a aeroplane, send it to another country. So you didn't see the Olympic Games. It was a 3-day lag time because of technology. But now it's instantaneous. So she was trying to learn the history of that whole process. And it was hard, it was difficult, there were lots of dates, there were lots of numbers, there were lots of almost conflicting information that she had to grapple with on along a timeline. So what we did was we took that hard and she's, by the way, she's an artist, she loves drawing. So we actually made a graphic of the timeline. And so we drew it and we made it make sense to her. And then we repeated and repeated and repeated. And then finally, she was able to do it from memory, which, by the way, is another blind spot for our learners, because they sometimes don't understand that passing exams are just memory tests. They're being tested on their memory. And so we have to be able to remember the information without the visuals, without having it in front of us. Can we do it from just our head? And so that's really important for them to be able to do that. So she was able to go through that hard, take a strategy of making it visual, because that was her way of understanding the world, until it got to easy.
And what are some of the things that hold these students back?
I think it's just not knowing the strategies
because we don't really, you work in many, many different countries. They don't really teach strategies, or do they in some countries?
No.
Is that crazy?
I know. Every school, I've worked in 20 countries on 6 continents, and every country that I work in, the students go home, and parents, you'll know this, when they come home, you say, what did you do at school today? And they say, nothing.
Nothing.
It's an international curriculum. Students do nothing everywhere around the world. It's not true. But nothing means, I believe, it was the same as yesterday. It was the same as the day before. It's the same, same, same. And I don't see the purpose and I don't see the value. Mm-hmm. So if students don't see the purpose and the value, then that becomes one of the biggest struggles. Like, why should I? Why mm-hmm. should I? I'm having a struggle with my own daughter around getting her to school on time, because she says, why should I be there on time? The teacher is not in the classroom and we don't do anything for the first 10 minutes. And actually, she's right.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, why should she? So I think we also need to listen to our students, because if there's no meaningfulness for them. And my own daughter is, we call her Sporty Spice. She plays two major sports in at rep level. She's 17. And she has got one more year of high school to go before she could go off to college or university. And I've had to let go of my dream of that final year and her graduation, because it's going to be not purposeful for her. And she's going to now go to a sports college, and that will be purposeful for her.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that, I think sometimes our students are just wondering what the value is, and that holds them back a lot.
I think that's one of the hardest things about my job coaching these students, is when I look at them and I say, you're right, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, why am I doing all this busy work or all these things, or when am I ever going to use this? Now, there are times when, you know, the type of thinking you're practicing is useful or whatever, but the fact that they're having the experience of not sensing meaning and purpose in it is really hard, because I'm trying to essentially lead a horse to water and get them to drink. How do I help you do the things that need to be done, even though you don't want to? And sometimes when they don't want to, it's just that avoidance and anxiety and resistance. Right. But sometimes when they don't want to, they're really like, look, this teacher doesn't even seem like they like me. I'm not interested in the subject matter. It's really a tough place for us to be, and we're not going to change that overnight. So let me get a little bit off target and ask you about that. We're not going to change that overnight. So what do you say to students when they say that? How do you say, hey, you know, I know you don't want to do this, but I'm going to help you get strategies to do it anyhow? What kind of conversations do you have around that?
One of the things I do talk to students about is that 50% of what they learn in school, particularly high school, they will never use, and it's probably more. But the challenge is, we don't know in the 21st century which half we're going to need. So for instance, for me, even being in school in the 20th century, I didn't like English. I didn't pay attention. I dropped English as soon as I was allowed. I didn't hand anything in. I didn't respect the teacher. But if you told me when I was 15, 16 years old that one day I'd write books, I'd have laughed at you. If you told me that when I was 15 or 16 years old that I would be publishing an international magazine, I'd have laughed at you. If you told me when I was 15 and 16 that one day I would make a living by making speeches, which is what I do, I'd have laughed, because I would have said there's no way. But what I did, so what I tell these students is, it's about the ability to be what I call lifelong learners. So it's about those learning to learn strategies behind it. And in all times, in all life, we have to do things we don't want to do. So it is the bigger picture and those bigger strategies. Yeah. Yeah.
This summit is brand new for me. I'm learning all. I am a lifelong learner. I love learning. But there are parts of it that I do, like I like the interviewing. Awesome. This is fun for me. I love unpacking people's, but to be able to then take the video, upload it, do all the 700 steps, and it's like, I don't want to do so, but I've had to learn how to work with myself to figure out how to execute on the parts that I don't want to. And we do need to help kids do that, so that when they do really have goals that are meaningful and purposeful, they can achieve them. And the risk is, if they can't execute, they can't do the things that do matter to them.
And I'm the same. I'm a business owner. I have employees, and I had an employee who was doing a website for me that was time sensitive. And then he suddenly said on the Friday, I can't do this, and walked out. And so I had to spend the entire weekend learning how to program a website, and had it ready for Monday morning. Because I'm a lifelong learner, I didn't want to have to learn how to do that, but now I know.
When it comes down to it, you can.
I can if I have to.
Do what you need. So what are some of the common misunderstandings or myths that parents have? So parents are watching this right now. What are some of the misunderstandings that you see all the time?
Around learning?
Around kids who struggle with executive function.
Myths and misunderstandings. I guess it is around that, what they need to learn. Around the biggest one is probably that it is a memory test, and so can your child do it from the remember it from from their brain, from memory, without having to have notes and having to have all the information in front of them. It's probably the biggest myth. Oh, well, the biggest myth would be that passing exams has got to do with intelligence, which it really doesn't. It's about the strategies and the techniques and the learning and your ability to memorize.
So how do you help a parent then learn how to get those strategies? Is that, should we wait for that? Should we talk about that in a few?
Yeah, we can talk about that whenever you like.
Let me look at my questions real quick before we get to that. Let's talk, you work a lot with teachers. What are some of the blind spots or myths or mistakes that you commonly see with teachers?
Possibly that one size fits all. That if I teach by standing at the front of the classroom, by just lecturing, that everyone will learn that way. The other one is that it's the student's responsibility to learn from me.
Those are hand in hand, huh?
Yeah. So I guess the biggest blind spot, I guess, at that point in myth is that just because I taught it, teachers assume that students learned it. But there's actually a very big difference between teaching and learning. Just because you taught it doesn't mean learning has occurred.
And why do you think that so many teachers believe that? Because I see that a lot in the States as well.
I think that is a systemic issue that happened when education first started. Do you know, when mass education first started, the teachers were the only people who had traveled, who had read the books, who had knowledge. And so those people just taught in the style that they learned best in themselves, and a lot hasn't changed. Even look at the way our students take notes in class, it's still with blue or black pen ink, and which is what our great grandparents use. But we know from neuroscience that color is actually much better for note taking. So there's so many things that have happened in schools that are systemic from the way the education system was set up.
So let's start unpacking, what do you do about all this stuff? Before we get into the how, when you've seen a student who really has gone from that point A to that point B, and at point B they've really got strategies, they've got some metacognition, some executive function, some time management, some planning skills, they can really handle stuff. What does it look like? Again, I guess once they have those tools, what's that like?
Yeah, so it looks like they're organized. It looks like that they have a place to study, that they have a time and a timetable that they stick to. It looks like, as I said earlier, asking questions in class, maybe having others around to work with and study with and learn with. It looks like students who are empowered to be able to use the internet as a learning tool, because one of the big things I see is many students just use the internet as an entertainment tool. So we're watching cat videos or playing online games, which is great, but actually they often don't see that the internet has the ability for them to be a great learner as well.
So what process have they gone through to get to that? What concepts have you taught them, or models? Okay. strategies.
Yeah. So I teach the 7 keys to memory. So the 7 keys to memory are looking at primacy, how the brain remembers the first things that we do. So when we're studying, it's important to go over our important information first. Then we talk about recency, the 2nd key to memory, which means it's much easier to remember what we did yesterday than it is to remember what we did 6 weeks ago. So we want to be able to go back over our learning and over our notes at the end of a study time, so that we know, hey, this is what we've done. And so like that summary each study time. It looks like key 3 is this repetition, being able to go over and over and over and over. And the repetition schedule is to go over information a day later, a month later, and every 6 months. A day, a week, a month, and every 6 months. If you want information at 90% recall, one of the things we absolutely know from neuroscience is that when we go over information within 24 hours, so whatever you're learning on the summit, if you go and tell somebody about it within 24 hours, your recall can stay at 90%. If you read your notes, if you tell somebody, if you do something with the information. If you don't do anything with the information within 3 days, we forget 70% of that information. So remembering that exams are memory tests, we want to go over that information as often as we can. So I teach a little strategy about students having a little notebook. So just a tiny notebook where each day they summarize their notes into that notebook, one per subject. So if they have a math notebook, they'll have a English notebook maybe, they maybe have a science notebook, whatever their subjects are. And every day they summarize their notes into that notebook. Now the reason it's a notebook is to force a summary. There is a slight difference between the way boys and girls study. This is a gross generalization, but boys tend to just pick up their notes and flick through their pages and go, oh, I know that. Yes, I know that. Oh, I've seen that. Oh, that was fun. Oh, yes, that was important. And they close their book. And so they think by just looking at it that they've remember it. But again, in an exam, when they don't have their notes with them, it's much harder for them to access. Girls, again, as a gross generalization, girls tend to rewrite their notes in full. And it's a total waste of time because students could copy when they were 5 years old, and copying is boring for the brain when you're a teenager, when you're older. And when they start copying their notes, what happens is they get bored. The brain gets bored. So I bet you've experienced this when you're doing something mundane and boring, is that you're doing the mundane and you're boring, but your brain is thinking, I wonder what's for dinner. I wonder what we should do tomorrow night. Oh, I must download that app. Oh, I must ring so-and-so. And so the brain starts thinking about something else. And as incredible as our brain is, when we're learning, the brain can't do two things at once. You can't be learning and processing other information at the same time. So the notebook forces us to summarize the notes, to come up with a summary of how, what are the key points? What don't I know that I need to remember? What will I need to remember on the test? So that's a quick example of one of the key strategies that we teach. And that's around the 3rd key to memory.
So one of the things that, first of all, with a lot of the kids who struggle with executive function is there's going to be that resistance to, oh, I don't feel like summarizing, or they'll just do it and it'll be like a shortcut and they'll just get it done to get you off their back. How do you sell them on it or get buy-in or ownership in terms of the summary? And then I have some more questions about this.
So I think the buy-in really is about understanding how the brain works, that the brain needs to go over it a day later, a week later, a month later. And so taking 20 minutes a day, that's all it should take to be able to summarize those notes from one day in a classroom. So summarize your notes 20 minutes a day, that in itself can keep your marks at 90% plus, because that's the kind of recall you're going to have. So I don't know, it depends. Do you want to spend 20 minutes a day to be highly successful and remember and recall your information? Or do you want to be really stressed out at the end of the year trying to learn all of it and you can't remember any of it? Because otherwise, if you don't do this at the end of the year, you have to start relearning it from scratch again because you can't recall it.
So for parents watching, I asked that question because you're going to have to get buy-in from your child in order to apply this. So I really agree with that. Like, first of all, talking about that you are going to learn it so much better now and you will have less studying and less stress in the future. And also talking about that this, talking about the brain. So parents, even if you don't know a lot about how the brain works, even small conversations about this is what's going on in the brain are helpful. And thank you for mentioning summarizing, because that's something that I talk about a lot about. So I've worked with a lot of different ages, and I worked with third grade, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and now I work with high school, college. Summarizing is a skill. And I know that for third graders, to ask them to summarize something, so there are going to be parents watching that are have young kids and then parents with college kids and everything in between. But if your child is young and they can't summarize very well, that's to be expected. And I think that there's probably value, and you can probably attest to this, and even verbal summarization for younger kids, like just tell me, and then asking some leading questions and not answering the question for your child. Being okay with an imperfect summary, written or verbal, but like you can ask some more leading questions, but not feeling like you have to give them the perfect summary, or, you know, like it's okay. We're developing a giant skill. We're not worried about really the specific summary. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. So there are many different ways to summarize. So yes, talking about it, writing about it, doing a mind map, bullet points and key points. And as part of the summit, one of the things I've got in the package for parents, chart on how to summarize. So I can, I'll make sure you get that as a download.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. And you had mentioned some steps. I forget, honestly, what the first, I didn't write it down. The first one started with a P and then an R. You can see kind of how my brain works.
Yeah. So that's great. Remembering. primacy, the things that happen first, and then recency, the things that happen last.
Can you go into primacy a little more? Because I what does that mean?
Okay. So your brain is designed to remember the first time you do something. So for instance, you're more likely to remember your first day at school than you are to remember your 10th day at school. You're more likely to remember the first time you drove a car than the 20th time you drove a car. You are most likely to remember your first kiss, but not the 17th kiss. Unless, of course, they were on the same, they were on the same night, you know, 1 to 17. The brain is designed to remember first. So we use this when we are studying. So we want our kids to be able to think, so when I sit down, if my brain is going to remember what I do first, let's do what's really important first. So that's what I don't know. It's what I got wrong in a test or an exam. It's something that I know that is really important that I have to learn or I have to get done. So it's what's that book? Eat the Frog first or something. So it's do the big thing first that you need your brain to be able to learn or remember, and then you can move on to the others.
So you generally apply that to a study session or an evening of homework, the correct, primacy concept. And correct, then what was the R was the recency.
So that's the last. So your brain is also remembers the things that happen last. So for instance, it's much easier to remember what you had for dinner last night for your evening meal. Do you call it dinner?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Some people call it supper. Is that why?
Yes, I was just wondering. So whatever you had for supper last night, it's much easier to remember that than if I said to you, what did you have for supper like 6 weeks ago.
Yep, yep.
But unless it was a special occasion or a date that stands out, you're not going to remember.
Or a primacy experience. Like six weeks ago, I just ate at this new restaurant. That was amazing.
Correct, right? Correct. So the brain remembers the firsts and the lasts. And so the more firsts and lasts that we can create when we're learning is also really important. And so one of my study tips that fits with this primacy and recency is to study for 20 minutes and take a 5 minute break. Now, most traditional books about study will tell students to study for 50 minutes or an hour and take a 10 minute break. But if you do that, you have one primacy and one recency. You have a beginning and an end to your hour time frame. But what if you just studied smarter? What if you studied for 20 minutes and took a 5 minute break? 20 minutes and took a 5 minute break, 20 minutes and took a 5 minute break. You see, now in that hour time frame, or just over, there are six opportunities. There's six first and last, three of each, that it's much easier to remember the information.
Interesting, because I think a lot of times we tend to think more, but it's like making it more bite-sized actually has more power.
Correct. It creates motivation because they go, oh, I can do 20 minutes. It is definitely that bite size, and particularly when it's difficult and it's hard. If you're in what I call the flow, so it's all just happening and it's easy and it's just working well, then keep going. But if it's challenging and difficult, then you want to stop every 20 minutes. And so I have there's an app you can download that I designed for this, and it's called the iStudy Alarm. And it has, it's totally free. It, as it suggests, you push it and it times you for the 20 minutes. It gives you about a 2 minute revision break, and then it times the students for their 5 minute break. And so I know that hundreds of thousands of students around the world are finding that really useful.
Okay, awesome. And what, in terms of sort of, you have the student's struggling with executive function stuff, they're learning better skills for studying. What other concepts or background do parents need to know to?
Okay, so we just did the first three tips, so we better do the other four.
Great.
So tip number four is to make information stand out. Funny, weird, and strange is what the brain loves. Funny, weird, and strange is what the brain remembers. So it's a survival mechanism of the brain to notice anything that's unusual, different, strange. And we can use that when we're studying. Uh-huh. So this is using color, making sure that the more colorful your notes are, the more they stand out. Highlighting is another way, but if you highlight all your notes, they all look the same.
Right. We have to teach kids to highlight, yeah.
But by the way, the best color for memory and the color that your brain sees first is the color red. And red is the color the brain sees first. But if students write all their notes in red, it's not going to stand out anymore. So we have to have lots of different ways to make things stand out. Making up raps, rhymes, and rhythms. I'm sure we can link these with the package that parents will get from me, but I have a rap song on these study tips. So can we link that somehow for them?
Yep, we can do that, okay. Yeah.
So, you know, if they can make up a song, one of my rap songs, the students actually only listen to it once. It's 45 seconds long, and they instantly know 8 strategies to how to set up a study environment. They only listen to it once, and it's like suddenly the information is just there. So it's any way we can make information stand out, funny, weird, and strange.
And what did you call that number four?
Stands out.
Okay. And I'm a huge fan of that too. And I know that they've done studies with memory champions who memorize decks of cards. And And I think that the best one memorized like 10 decks of cards, which is 520 randomized decks of cards, but they make crazy stories in their head. And when I'm sitting with a student and we make crazy ways to remember the things, they will remember it for a long, long time.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know someone who in San Francisco, there must be a road in San Francisco that goes from one end of San Francisco right to the other. She drove that road and memorized in one trip each road that came off that main road. And could tell you in order all of them. Now, her son, who thought that was pretty amazing but wanted to outdo her, memorized the Los Angeles telephone book.
Wow, that's crazy.
I know, it's a bit stalker material, really. But name, address, phone number. And so the brain has huge capacity to be able to do this, but yes, it's about making it stand out, making it weird, funny, strange.
And I like how you talked about the drawing too. I teach my students to draw their notes, and we use these four click Bic pens that have red, black, blue, and green. And, but I want it really visual because it stands out more to the brain. Awesome. Absolutely. So
that's number four. Number five is association. So it's linking things together. And this is what we were talking about earlier when students say, I don't know why I'm learning this. So having a reason to learn the information is really important.
Connecting it to something you already,
know or already understand. And so even if it's that students have to Google trigonometry in real life, and they go, oh, that's how trigonometry is used in life. They might not ever need to use it, but at least they have some understanding of the importance of what they're learning. Mm-hmm. So being able to use the internet to do that. One of the things I often talk to students about around association is also about, as we talked about earlier, this ability to use the internet to learn. And I often say to students, and I get this complete dead silence as the penny drops, if you don't understand the information from your teacher, Google another teacher. Google, there are hundreds and thousands of sites you can go to and find other teachers teaching the information that you're trying to learn. Universities such as Stanford and Harvard have their courses online for free. And all of these sites that I mention and I talk to students about are for free. And I say to them, I hate it when they're free. And they look at me and go, why? And I say, because it means you've got no excuse. Mm-hmm. And there's that penny drop. It's like, oh, we don't just have to learn from our teacher. We can learn from the internet, from other places, hundreds of free sites that we can go to, instant access.
And there are so many people who are super passionate about something, and they may be more passionate than your teacher about the thing, and are super engaging. And that passion is infectious. So
correct.
I'm a big fan of getting, of even just hearing a different way that somebody different explains the exact same concept is so valuable. Okay. So
association. Yeah.
Oh, can I mention on association too? That's a great time to connect it to their interests and their hobbies and their passions. And
absolutely. Absolutely. Now the sixth one is visuals, which you talked about just before. Is making sure students draw pictures and diagrams. They make their notes look really visual. I would go further than the four colored pen. Mm-hmm. I would prefer they have at least 12 colors and use the non-traditional colors. So your pinks, your purples, your oranges, those sort of colors, which really end up looking, making your notes look beautiful. But when you, I want to do this little exercise for the parents. So I'm going to ask you to please close your eyes in a moment. I'm going to ask you to close your eyes, and then I'm going to say something. Notice what happens in your brain when I say what I say. So, okay, please close your eyes. Apple. 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 Please open your eyes. Now, Seth, what happened inside your brain when I said the word apple?
So first I had a pretty very standard image of an apple, red with a little leaf on it. And then the second time I saw like a tree emerge. And then the third time I thought about the person who just walked out my window and then went back to the tree and the apple.
Okay, thank you. So most people, 97% of people when we do that activity will see an apple of some form, a red apple, a green apple, an apple tree, a computer, Mac apple, maybe the Big Apple from New York, whatever, there'll be some form of image inside the brain. Only about 3% of the population will actually see the word A-P-P-L-E. So what that tells us, when you look at students' notes, they're mostly words. But the brain is taking words that they hear and turning it into visual pictures.
I'm so with you.
Yep. So we have to teach students how to take notes in a visual form, to draw pictures and diagrams. Now, I can't draw.
That's the objection that a lot of people say. So yeah. Good. I'm glad you said that.
I am hopeless at drawing, but you'd be amazed at how many people, but I do it anyway, and you'd be amazed at how many people say to me, you're so creative. Oh no, they're pathetic drawings, but I have high self-esteem, so I can laugh at my own drawings. I don't mind if other people laugh at them, but I know they help me remember. So yeah, so encouraging that drawing and doodling is also useful as well.
And then for me, I do a lot with kids where I'll have them draw their notes or draw concepts and then tell me what they drew. So it may be a drawing where I have no, I look at it and I say, oh, that's a mountain. That doesn't look like a mountain to me. That looks like this, but it doesn't matter. What matters is they know and they can explain it. And the way that that encodes or sticks in the head is just remarkable, way better than just the written.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and by the way, for the parents watching, if when I said the word apple, nothing happened, stay calm. for a few people, nothing happens. Maybe you suddenly felt hungry, or maybe you heard the crunch of an apple, or so you might not have had a visual picture at all, and that's perfectly normal and fine as well. But most people will see some sort of visual form of the apple when I say that word. So that's drawing the visuals. That's number six. And number seven is called chunking. Chunking information into small, manageable pieces. The second most important study tip I ever teach is this one, is to only learn 3 or 4 pieces of information at a time. Not subjects, pieces of information. So if you have 10 chemical formulas to learn, then you do do the first three. Check you know them. Then do the next three. Check you know them, and then go back and check you know all of them. And then do your final four. Check you know them. Check you know them all. And so you
I'm
chunk
it. I'm stealing that one for sure. I chunk in different ways and batch, but that's so good. I can just see how they would get so much more traction. Also because if they focus on the three and get those really well, I feel like if it's within the same subject matter, what they've mastered in those three is going to make the other ones easier.
Right.
Excuse me.
Yeah. So if you've got if you're learning about a book that you've written and it's the plot of the play and there are, 10 things you need to know about the plot of the play, just do the first three. It's actually called snowballing. So this idea that in certain places in America, you'll have this beautiful snow that if you take the snowball at the top of the mountain and you roll it down, it will continue to get more and more and more, and you'll end up with the big snowball at the bottom of the mountain. And so that's what we want to do. Just start with a little and then add a little more and then add a little more until you've got a whole lot. So chunking it down.
I love it.
Yeah, simple little strategy.
Thank you. And let's see, are there other models or concepts or backgrounds that you want to dive into?
Yeah. I could spend all day, of course, Seth.
Let's do one more good one and then we'll wrap up. I have a couple of wrap-up questions.
Okay. All right. We did talk about the 16 behaviors right at the start. So I think and I'll provide a card. It looks like this, so that parents can have a look at this. But these are the behaviors of successful people. They're the behaviors of what do you do when you're stuck and you don't know what to do, which I think is really important when students are struggling with that executive function. It's like they often feel themselves stuck. And so just to quickly talk about some of them, one of them is to persist. So how do you persist? How do you keep going when you're stuck and you don't know what to do? Another one is to manage your impulsivity. So instead of screaming and yelling or blurting things out, is to stop and think about what you're going to do before you do it.
Those are two different ones from the card?
Yes, two different ones from the card. Yeah. Another one from the card is about striving for accuracy. So many students just go, oh, done it, she'll be right. But have you checked your work? Have you gone back? Because successful people go back and they check for accuracy. They check for craftsmanship to make sure it's the best that they can do. So there are 16 different behaviors there, which I'll put with a package that parents can have a look at, because these are also the strategies that will help the students put the study tips into play.
And those are exactly executive function things as I teach them.
Correct.
So awesome. So what successful people do essentially is figure out how to deal with their resistance and avoidance and anxiety and execute anyway.
Correct. Yeah.
Nice.
So yes. So you'll get parents, you'll get that card so you can have a look and explore them further.
All right. So two things to wrap up. The first one is, what actions, in terms of your methodologies and your beliefs, what actions should parents take this week, in the upcoming week, to implement something that you teach or to help their child who struggles with executive function?
Right. So let me just ask you this question, Seth. When we're watching this, is that the beginning of the school year?
Yep.
Perfect. So our school year in New Zealand is slightly different, but I thought that. Okay, so beginning of the school year, parents, have a conversation to your students about your expectations. What is it that you want them to be able to achieve? What do they want? What kind of help do they want from you? Do they want you to ask every day, have you got any homework? Do you need to do some study? Do they want you to ask, or do they want you to leave them alone? And so talk to your child about what's going to help them best in the way you respond to them. Know their schedule and know what they've got every day. I find the question, instead of asking my child or my children, what did you do at school today? I'll say, which subjects did you have today? Then they'll say, well, I had geography and I had science and I did English. And I said, oh, how's that English project going? So that leads me into the conversation about what they're doing in class. Or what are you doing in science at the moment? Which part of science are you studying? So that leads me into the conversation. Make sure that to know their weekly schedule, I think, is important. And so, you know, our children have things out of school as well as in school. And so every Sunday evening when we're having our supper around the kitchen table, my family, we still do this and we've been doing it for years. We talk about what's everyone doing this week, and we have a written schedule. So we know when the sport practices, when people need to be taken places, when people will be home for dinner or supper or not. So make sure you have that conversation. Provide great food for your children, brain food, food that's going to sustain their brains rather than that quick fix, high sugar, processed food. And make sure they're getting enough sleep. And this is contentious with teenagers, and I know it's hard, but sleep is really important. So there's a rule in my house, no phones allowed in their bedrooms, no technology allowed in their bedrooms. And yeah, it's hard to fight that battle sometimes, but I'm really clear, your sleep is important. And if that phone pings in the middle of the night and wakes you up, then you're not going to get that good quality sleep. And then finally, I'd say to parents, just remain positive, support your child and be positive about the things they're doing and look for the good in what they're doing.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you. That was fantastic. And my last question of all is this. From your heart, you got all those hearts, from your heart to the parents that are watching right now, what is the number one most important takeaway you hope people leave with right now?
School, you know, school is just part of the bigger picture, I guess, the maybe the smaller picture. School isn't the be all and end all. If your child is struggling in school, they will probably, if you provide them with love, if you surround them with that support and tell them and teach them they're a great person, even if they don't pass all the subjects at school, even if they don't get into college or meet the dreams that you have for them, they're still wonderful children. My son failed his last year in school, and I still love him, and he's gone and got a job, and he's contributing to the world, and he's doing amazing things. It's not what I had on my plan for him, but you know, he's an amazing child at 19. My daughter, as I said earlier, you know, she's a sports mad, and I'd had this whole graduation year in my head and all the things they get to do, and I've been hanging out for that for years, visualizing it, and I have to let go of that picture because it's not what's right for her. What's right for her is to go to sport college and, you know, be immersed in the things that she loves. And so I guess from my heart to parents, it's about don't worry so much about whether they pass or fail. Don't worry so much about what happens in school. Yes, support them through it, but there's a bigger picture and there's life that they have to live.
Mm. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks, Karen. I appreciate your time. And parents out there, thank you. I hope you got a lot out of this, and go take action. I'll see you in the next one. Take care.